program is rated PG-13. Parental guidance is advised. Hey, good evening, Truth Seekers. I just had to do that one time. Matter of fact, I think I'm going to do that every night. Why not? Yeah, this is a PG-13 show. So, welcome to Friday night. How you doing? Are you in the Christmas spirit yet? Boy, I am. Yes. Well, winter solstice. Well, Christmas. I mentioned last night, I was explaining to Molly last night when she was going to sleep, the overlap between winter solstice season and Christmas, and how the early Christians decided that, you know, they would just co-opt this Celtic slash pagan holiday, been around for a long time, and why the winter solstice was celebrated the way it was celebrated, with the lights and the dancing and the parties and gay apparel and so on and so forth, and the bonfires. And so she laid there and listened, and tonight she asked me to tell her that again. So I told her the whole thing again. And then she sat up in bed and looked at me and she said, "Daddy, I have something to tell you." And I said, "What's that?" "Christmas is about the birth of Jesus." All right. Yeah, so I said, "You know, you're right. That's what Christmas is about." I'm just trying to explain to you, deck the halls with Boston Charlie, Walla Walla Wash in Kalamazoo. You know, just trying to explain that part of it. Hey, did you hear about this guy, Cecil Bothwell, or Bothwell? I guess it's Bothwell. He was just elected to the city council in Asheville, North Carolina, which is not very far from here. I have friends that live in Asheville. It's just across a few of the lower Appalachian Mountains that you have to cross over to get from metro Atlanta to North Carolina. And beautiful. Asheville, North Carolina is beautiful. That's where, what's his name, the big industrialist that built the big mansion up there, Biltmore. Who was that? Vanderbilt. You know, one of the real rapacious capitalists. You look at that place, you look at Biltmore. I don't know if you all get commercials about traveling to Biltmore in other parts of the country, but down here, it's, you know, you go there for Christmas, I guess, to look. You go through Biltmore, and it has, like, I don't know, 150 rooms, and it's built like, a French mansion. I think it's modeled on French aristocracy, or modeled on the, not the Louvre, but aristocratic French Louis XIV style mansion, and it's just hundreds of rooms. And that's not exaggerating. All right, maybe 100, 150. But it is an example of wretched excess beyond belief. It makes the Hearst Castle in California look like an outhouse, frankly. Sorry, no offense to California. But Asheville is really a pretty city. It's up in the Blue Ridge Mountains, which are part of the Appalachian Mountains. It's really cool up there, and a lot of artists have moved up there, a lot of writers, a lot of people who just couldn't handle any longer the craziness of, say, Atlanta or Charlotte or Nashville or Cincinnati or wherever, and just decided to migrate to Asheville, North Carolina. Well, Cecil Bothwell got elected to city councilman. He ran on the platform. He believes in ending the death penalty, conserving water, reforming government. You can see how he would win. Most people look at North Carolina. Well, that's part of the South. North Carolina is kind of a purple state anyway. But Asheville is totally blue. But there's a fly in the ointment here. Cecil Bothwell does not believe in God. He said he's 59 years old. He said, quote, "The question of whether or not God exists is not particularly interesting to me, and it's certainly not relevant to public office. But the Republicans, the conservatives in Asheville are raising a great big stink now, threatening to take the city to court for swearing him in, even though the state's antiquated requirement that office holders believe in God is unenforceable because it violates U.S. Constitution. But this shows the dumbassery of conservatives, of Republicans. Yeah, North Carolina still has on its books this. The North Carolina Constitution disqualifies office holders, quote, "who shall deny the being of Almighty God," end quote. The provision was included when the state constitution was drafted in 1868, and it wasn't revised when North Carolina amended its constitution in 1971. So one of the people threatening to file a lawsuit is this guy named H.K. Edgerton. He said, "My father was a Baptist minister. I'm a Christian man. I have problems with people who don't believe in God." He is a former president of the NAACP and the founder of Southern Heritage 411, an organization that promotes the interests of black Southerners. But he said, since his father was a Baptist minister and he's a Christian man, he has problems with people who don't believe in God. Now, you would think that Mr. Edgerton would just, I don't know, snub people like that, or you know, if you do what Jesus said, you would go over and give the atheist a hug, kiss him on the cheek, invite him over to dinner. But not Mr. Edgerton. No. So, the point I'm trying to make here, let's be real. It's just not Caucasians who are dumbasses. You know, black folk can be dumbasses too, right? Does everybody agree with that? Is that okay to say? Especially here in the South, especially when you have Caucasians and black people who try to keep an awful lot of distance between each other because this is the South. But one of the rallying points is what? They got an atheist on the Asheville City Council? Hell, let's go. Come on. Everybody hide your KKK hoods and let's join up with the Negroes and go remove this boy. Let's get rid of this boy, this atheist, son of a bitch. I mean, that's what it's like down here. That's why I like living down here. It's insane. See, it's just totally insane. And it doesn't make any difference to these people that the U.S. Constitution prohibits a religious test for any public office. It doesn't make any difference that this is in total violation of what amendment? I don't know, 14, 17, 24, 59th. It doesn't matter. The dumbassery down here sometimes is exceeded only by the beauty of this part of the country. And, you know, to answer, a lot of people say, well, why do you stay down there? That's because I like it here. Where do you get this kind of comedy? You know? Son of a bitch. Oh, well. Let me see what else we got here. When I saw that today, I just, I thought, oh, please. And Bothwell, you know, Bothwell, the guy that got elected, the guy who is an atheist or whatever, he goes to the, attends the Unitarian Universalist Congregation, which is what I said this week that Kathy and I were considering. Do you join that? Do you sign up for it? I don't even know. We'll have to go find out. Do you take an oath? Do you have to be baptized in the blood of a caterpillar or something? I have no idea what the UUs do, but we're going to check it out so that Molly gets a second opinion on all this God stuff. And but he's this guy Bothwell is a member of the UU Church, one of the I guess you don't call it a church, a UU congregation in Asheville. And he says, look, you know, I'm, what do you mean atheist? You know, what do you mean? He said, the point is irrelevant. You know, God, no God. You know, forget it. We got work to do. And, you know, you gotta tend to, applaud somebody like that, right? Hey. All right. We have, late this afternoon, Ezra Klein, writing in the Washington Post on one of the blog sites, reported on something that's inside the Senate health insurance reform bill. You know, the one that Harry Reid said, we're going to run it by the Congressional Budget Office, and then we'll talk about what's in it. And the members of the Democratic caucus in the Senate said they have no idea what's in this bill. The bill that they, I guess, voted on or whatever they did. And then after they voted on it, rather than discuss everything that's in it, Harry Reid decided to send it to Congressional Budget Office, see how much it's going to cost. There's always, somebody who's willing on the coldest night of the year to fart under the blankets, right? And, well, we've got it for you. It's coming up in just a minute. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
I wonder what I do if Uh-oh, he just had another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Podcast trivia coming up after the next break. So we will be opening up the lines during the bottom of the hour break and would really like to give away a free subscription to you. By the way, if you are looking for a stocking stuffer or something, go to our website. If you actually buy a subscription to Commercial Free Malloy podcast downloads at $59.40 a year, you get a second year to send to a friend absolutely free. So that means you wind up spending half of $59.40 on yourself and the other half on a friend or an enemy. Do consider it. All right. Ezra Klein, late this afternoon, discovered something in the Senate bill that allows insurers, the insurance company, to establish annual limits. Huh? Now, allegedly in the insurance bill, there is no lifetime limit on, they can't cap the insurance, the insurers. They can't put a cap on how much they have to pay out over the years. So, I mean, over the lifetime of the policy. They have, just reams of evil little people with sharp teeth who look through your entire history, if you have a big claim, to see where you lied about a mole on your face or a pimple on your ass. And that's in the fine print, you know. If you lie about a pimple on your ass,
but they didn't ask me about a pimple on my ass.
Yes, they did. If you look at the teeny tiny, teeny, teeny, teeny print, you'll find it. Then they can cancel your policy. You see, but this enters into a whole new realm. The Associated Press says a loophole in the Senate health care bill would let insurers place annual dollar limits on medical care for people struggling with costly illnesses such as, oh, pick one, cancer. The Senate Finance Committee had barred these caps altogether. But somehow it snuck in. Oh, my. The merged Senate bill only erases unreasonable annual caps. Here's a question for you, truth seeker. What is unreasonable? Huh? What's unreasonable? If you are treating your child, if your child is in treatment for neuroblastoma or one of the childhood cancers, what is a reasonable or an unreasonable cap for a year? Huh? If you're the parent, there is no such thing. The life of your child is at stake. If you're the insurance company,
oh, listen, we're very sorry, but, you know, we can't go over $750,000. Sorry. No more chemo for you.
Sources on Capitol Hill explained that this was inserted, this bit about annual dollar limits on medical care. Was inserted because the Congressional Budget Office said premiums would, quote, go through the roof, end quote, if insurers couldn't cap the benefits. The official quote from Jim Manley, who is Harry Reid's spokesperson, says much the same thing. This is a quote, quote, "We are concerned that banning all annual limits, regardless of whether services are voluntary, could lead to higher premiums. We continue to work with experts on how best to accomplish our goals of preventing insurance companies from imposing arbitrary coverage limits while providing the premium relief American families need and deserve," end quote, garbage, hog snot. And I wish I could say what I really think of that sentence, but I can't. Of course, the sentence obscures the choice that's being made. The trade-off here, as Ezra Klein points out, is slightly higher premiums for everyone versus total financial ruin for people who absolutely need help the most. Now, politically, choosing everyone, you know, everyone pays a slightly higher premium rather than people with cancer makes sense because the first group has more votes than the second. You see? Of course. But on a policy level, it's nuts. Healthcare insurance literally exists to protect us from the worst case scenarios. So this provision says that the Senate bill will protect everyone but the truly worst case scenarios. If you assume that people support the basic concept of healthcare insurance, then they shouldn't support this. Right? But the American people are much more likely to hear that premiums are going to go up than they are to get a detailed explanation of what they're getting in return for higher premiums, which would be no annual caps. So that if you're struggling with a spouse, a child, a parent, whose treatment, I'm not talking about end-of-life treatment, I'm not talking about keeping grandpa on machines, I'm talking about people who have vibrant lives except for the fact they're dealing with leukemia or some other form of cancer or emphysema or Lou Gehrig's disease or something. And now this provision says that the insurance companies, while they can't put an overall cap on...
It ain't no use.
It's 7 past the hour. I'll tell you, it's colder than a well digger's ass here in the foothills of North Georgia Mountains. It is indeed. We got the heat cranked down, though, because we have forced air heat here. And with humidity outside around 22%, that means inside it's like the Mojave Desert if we keep the damn heat running. So, when we put Molly to bed tonight... Well, actually, when I put her to bed, Kathy's down here working the last few minutes of the show, but bundled her up with a couple of blankets and a sheet and all her teddy bears and all her little friends in there. And fairies hopping around outside of the window trying to get in. And big old quilt that, I don't know, passed down through the family from one side or the other. I don't know where it came from, but it's sure warm. And... But down here in the studio, three floors down, it's colder than hell. But that's all right. Keeps us awake. Right, Kathy? Alan is in Payson, Arizona. He says it's home to over 50 churches. And he writes, Mike, this ass clown, Senator James Inhofe, the global warming denier, is actually going to attend the global warming summit as a, quote, one-man truth squad, end quote. This is the fellow who believes in talking snakes and that the creator of the universe had his son tortured to death because I touched myself when I was 12 and maybe some other times, too. Science, bad. Magical, sadistic sky daddies, true. Whatever. All right, Alan, you just... You keep listening, you keep emailing in here, okay? I like getting your emails. President Barack Obama entered the pantheon of Nobel Peace Prize winners this morning with humble words, acknowledging his own few accomplishments while delivering a robust defense of war, and promising to use the prestigious award to, quote, reach for the world that ought to be, end quote. A wartime president honored for peace. So says Ben Feller, writing for the Associated Press. After nine days after ordering 30,000 more U.S. troops into battle in Afghanistan, Obama delivered a Nobel acceptance speech that he saw as a treatise on war's use and prevention. War's use and prevention. He crafted much of the address himself, and the scholarly remarks at about 4,000 words were nearly twice as long as his inaugural address. In them, Obama refused to renounce war for his nation or under his leadership, saying definitely, defiantly that, quote, I will face the world as it is, end quote. And he is obliged to protect and defend the United States. Obama said, quote, a nonviolent movement could not have halted Hitler's armies. Negotiations cannot convince al-Qaeda's leaders to lay down their arms. To say that force is sometimes necessary is not a call to cynicism. It is a recognition of history. End quote. Of course, I have a problem with that because, well, I'm the sort that when I see a blue spiral in the early morning sky over Norway, I immediately think, wow. I don't immediately think, oh, that's a collapsing missile. A nonviolent movement could not have halted Hitler's armies. Well, if you start the clock right there, you're probably right. But if you move the clock back 25 years before 1939 and the invasion of Poland, if you 25 years back to 1914, when the royal families of Europe, all of whom were related by blood, if not by marriage, were starting to have a big family squabble that was going to wind up killing probably 100 million people, given the phase one and phase two of the Great War, phase one being so-called World War One, phase two being so-called World War Two. If back around that time, well, maybe we should go back a little bit further. If Teddy Roosevelt hadn't gotten all froggy with the Spanish and felt like he had to jump, I don't know. To say that force is sometimes necessary is not a call to cynicism. It is a recognition of history. History repeats itself, Mr. President, first as tragedy and second as farce. Where are we? I mean, what comes after tragedy? And do I have it backwards? History repeats itself. First is farce, then is tragedy. Is it tragedy and farce? The point is, it doesn't matter. Isn't there a way to escape this? I don't know. I'm really disappointed in my president. I am sorely disappointed, and it's my fault. You know, it really is. It's my fault. I listened to Obama during the campaign, and I listened to how he could, honest to God, talk in paragraphs. He could start saying something, and 4,000 words later, tie the beginning back to the end, which is no mean feat, let me tell you. I mean, he came across, he was the president of, or the, whatever it is, the Harvard Law Review, or is it the Yale Law Review, or is it Princeton? Maybe it's Brown. I don't know, but it was a big time Ivy League school. He was a cosmopolitan, or is a cosmopolitan, you know. A mom who was this, a dad who was that, raised over here, brought back there. Had lots of influence from foreign to us cultures and religions and races and on and on and on. The kind of cosmopolitan that makes a hidebound, a Jesus-fearing Republican in this country wet his pants as he grabs for his Bible and his gun. But, gee, Mr. President, did it have to go down like this? Did you have to? I mean, why didn't you refuse to accept the Nobel Peace Prize? Why? I mean, of course, the Republican dunderheads, the rank and file with their head way up their asses, and the leadership, the Republicans in politics, I mean, they are war lovers and death and molding and stuff. Forget them. But for the people who kind of sort of respected your rhetorical ability, your intelligence, your logic, I mean, for us, why didn't you say, hey, guys in Norway, that's really nice, but I'm not going to... I realize that Mandela is in that group, and so is Schweitzer, and you know, but so also is Henry Kissinger. So I think I'll pass, okay? Besides, I don't deserve it! Would that have been so hard? Wouldn't that not have been an historical moment? Other Americans have won. Other people of color have won. Other statesmen have won. Other political leaders have won. Who's refused it? I don't know. I don't know. I didn't do my homework today. I didn't go to Wikipedia or wherever or ask.com. I don't know. But has anyone ever been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize and stood up on their hind legs and say, no, I don't think so, because I haven't done anything to deserve it. I'm actually a warmongering American, and I just committed, 20,000 more, 30,000 more troops to go kill and be killed. And you people must be out of your goddamn minds even considering me as a candidate. Are you crazy? It's a Nobel War Prize. Is that what it is? I talk a good talk, and I look cool. And I can swagger, and I'm not a dunderhead like Bush. But I'm still ordering people to their deaths. And you're going to give me the Nobel Peace Prize? What goes on up there in those long, dark nights? Do spirally things start showing up in the sky?
Because liberal is a good word. It's more Mike Malloy.
I face the world as it is. Kathy up in Green Bay says, now there's a vision for you. Yeah, I don't know. I guess that makes Barack Obama a realist in the Kathy Bay mold, whatever. I face the world as it is. I find that a little bit hard to believe. Not Barack Obama. I think his history would indicate that he saw the world as it is, and kind of like the eulogy for Bobby Kennedy, paraphrasing, of course, and you know, said, "Why not? Why can't I do this? What I'm who I am, and I think I'll be president of the United States." Is that facing? Did Barack Obama face the world as it is when he decided to run for president? Okay, well, maybe he did. He also spoke bluntly of the cost of war. He said that the Afghanistan buildup he just ordered regarding that here's a quote, "Some will kill, some will be killed," end quote. Now, I'm just tempted to get all hysterical on you right now and, you know, just get all fingernails on the chalkboard with that statement. But why bother? Really, why bother? Some will kill, some will be killed. I don't think I've ever heard a more relaxed, cavalier phrase about war than that one from anyone. I don't know. I didn't do a LexisNexis search to see if somebody else has ever said anything similar to that. Some will kill, some will be killed. I mean, that's cold. That has icicles on it. You know what I'm saying? And I don't care what he followed up with. He followed up, no matter how justified, war promises human tragedy. War justified. I don't know. I've really got problems with that. But Barack Obama is a hardcore Christian. You know that, don't you? I know the people with their head 20 feet up their asses would like to assume that he's a Muslim, but he's not. He's a hardcore Christian. And to hardcore Christians, hardcore Jews, and hardcore Muslims, the phrase, some will kill, some will be killed, is just a trippingly simple phrase. I mean, there's nothing cavalier about it at all, right? Malloy is just like, well, let's go down the ice cream store, and on the way down there, we might get run over by a truck, but we might not. So let's go have some ice cream. Some will kill, some will be killed. He also stressed the need to fight war according to what he said are, quote, the rules of conduct, end quote, that reject torture and other things. What? To reject torture. I've never been in combat and would never go. And if anybody in my family at this point, I mean, my offspring or the offspring of my offspring ever started talking about going into combat, I would do something terrible to them so that they would no longer be physically fit to go into combat. Unless we were invaded here, if somebody came in the neighborhood or the country or the state and started killing people, sure. But you know what I mean. I don't have to explain it again, do I? Rejecting torture. What is torture? Would lying on a battlefield of your creation, or the creation of your civilian leadership, and there you are, lying on a battlefield, and you look down, and you've got holes all over, and your body fluids are leaking out, and a couple of points they're gushing out into the ground, the sand, the jungle floor, the pavement, where, you know, wherever you are. But if you're in Afghanistan, you know, Kipling's lines about the women there come out and, well, you know, while you're dying, just roll over on your knife, soldier, or whatever it was. I'm forgetting the line. Don't send it to me. But isn't that torture? You're lying there and you're from Detroit or Atlanta or San Diego or Seattle, and you're lying there and you're 24 or 19 or 26 and you've got a wife, girlfriend, husband, buddy, friend, mom, dad. It's Christmas time back in Seattle or San Diego or Atlanta or Detroit, and you're lying there on the goddamn ground and you know you're dying. Isn't that torture? Or does torture only occur in the Winston Smith O'Brien scenario? Wouldn't that be torture? And when you deployed over here to Afghanistan, Vietnam, wherever it is you are, Iraq, I don't know. But when you deployed over here, what did you leave behind, soldier? You left your wife. And you left a 2-month-old baby. Isn't that torture? That soldier, that Marine, lying there on the ground and, you know, watching the dark red stain spreading from underneath him. And there's no pain because his body has gone into deep shock. Isn't that torture? I think it is.
Day Screaming with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Yeah, I missed it completely. Sometimes I wonder why there's any credibility attached to this program at all. Bill in Ottawa reminded me that Lay Duck Toe did refuse the Nobel Peace Prize. And it was 1973 when Lay Duck Toe and Kissinger were awarded jointly the 70th 1973 Nobel Peace Prize for their efforts in negotiating the Paris Peace Accords. However, Lay Duck Toe declined the award, stating there was still no peace in his country. Now that's honor, that's integrity. And that's what a man who That's what a man who is employed by the side in a conflict that will win will say. So, Bill and Ottawa, thanks. I completely missed that. Now that you sent me the email, now I remember. Roz in Canada writes, Mike, I heard a few people refer to Obama as a man of peace, but a peacemaker does not go to war. It's quite simply a case of by their fruits you shall know them. I'm left strangely cold by this president. Just because he speaks in a poetic way does not make him a good man. There's more to him than he'll show, and it may not all be good. I don't know. I just go with my feelings, Roz. Yeah, there is that, isn't there? Anyway, the need to fight war, according to what Barack Obama calls rules of conduct that reject torture and other methods, I don't know how you can do that. I had the misconception, as I guess maybe a few other people did, that Barack Obama was a man of peace. Dick Cheney and all Republicans love war as long as they don't have to fight it. They love seeing people go to war. They love the death and the smell and the stench and the murder and the mayhem and the chaos because they make money from that. As Smedley Butler said, war is a racket. But Barack Obama, you know, it's very difficult, isn't it, to look in the mirror and say to yourself, Jesus Christ, did I have this one wrong or what? And by the sense I'm getting from the tone of a lot of emails I'm receiving here lately, a lot of Obama supporters are now having to deal with that moment. A lot of people won't do that. A lot of people just try to find a rationalization for it. Well, you know, he's got a mess on his hands. Well, he's got to do this. Well, and I honestly, God, tried to do that. I did, you know. Well, he's got a mess on his hands. Look what these filthy Republicans handed him. Look how the filthy Republicans have withdrawn from governing the country. They've just withdrawn. They're not there, and that's probably a good thing. I mean, I don't know. I wish them all into a shake and bake stage of hell. All Republican office holders. The other ones, the ones with their head 20 feet up their asses, the Republican rank and file, forget them. Theirs is a very sorry lot. He emphasized, or Obama did, the need to exhaust alternatives to violence, using diplomatic outreach and sanctions with teeth to confront nations such as Iran or North Korea that defy international demands to halt their nuclear programs. Or those such as Sudan, Congo, or Burma that brutalizes their citizens, he says. Obama said, quote, let us reach for the world that ought to be. We can understand that there will be war, but still strive for peace, end quote. We can understand that there will be, will, not shall, will, there will be. It is the will of the people. It is not a future, an observation of potential future, which is the difference between will and shall. Will means what it is. There will be war. There shall be war is amendable. It can be changed. But there will be war means exactly what it says. And that's what Obama said. There will be war. How does the Nobel Peace Prize go to someone who says there will be war? How does that happen? How does that? And the next clause, and still strive for peace, is utterly meaningless. It's canceled by the first phrase, there will be war. That's a definitive statement. But we should strive for peace. That's nonsense. There shall be war, yet we should still strive for peace. It's a little bit easier to work with if you believe that war is not, and killing and murder and mayhem is not a human condition, that it can be transcended, right, right, right? But to follow up there will be war with strive for peace kind of fits in real very neatly with some will kill and some will be killed. I don't know, President Obama. You're breaking my mind. You really are. You're just breaking my mind into a million pieces. I don't know. I don't know. The Nobel Committee made its announcement in October when he wasn't even 9 months on the job. They said they were recognizing his aspirations more than his achievements. Okay, quick. Nobel Committee, I aspire to find a cure for cancer. Give me next year's Nobel Prize in Medicine. But I aspire to it. I think cancer's nasty. I want it gone. Give me the prize. Because he aspires to these. Okay, all right, I don't know. In awarding the prize to Obama, the Nobel panel cited his call for a world free of nuclear weapons. Physicians for Social Responsibility have been talking about that for 35 or 40 years. For a more engaged U.S. role in combating global warming. But, Mr. President, if you really mean that, then why are you not at the entire conference? Where is it? Copenhagen? Why are you not in a look? Our industrial base is in the toilet. We have millions of people out of work. Wouldn't this be a good time? I mean, you don't do it when the economy is humming along and the smokestacks are belching out all this poison. Do it now. There's nothing happening here. Just lobby or use executive order like your predecessor did. Just, you know, if you're really serious about bringing a halt. Oh, never mind. Never mind. Nobel cited his call for a world free of nuclear weapons for his support of the United Nations. Support of the United Nations, really. How many times has United Nations in their resolutions condemned the actions taken by the Israeli government against the Palestinian people who have been living in refugee goddamn camps for 50 years, 60 years now? How many times, Mr. President, has the United States abstained or voted no on a resolution condemning the actions of Israel against the Palestinians? So when you talk about support for the United Nations, come on. Come on, Mr. President. Come on. And for broadly capturing the attention of the world and giving its people hope. That's what he says he's striving for capturing the attention of the world and giving its people hope. Giving its people hope. Let us, Let's send an envoy to Congo. Let's send an envoy to Sudan. Let's send an envoy to Eritrea. You know, all those places that we read about and don't pay any attention to, where people are starving, where they look like walking skeletons. And let's go over there and say, ah, but there's hope. Now, I'm not trying to join the ranks of you cynics, but isn't that almost obscene? Can something be almost obscene? Isn't that obscene to talk about hope? Well, what are you talking about? There's no hope for anything in those parts of the world. Nothing. Hope doesn't exist. Hope was the first thing to go. And then the grass, and then the water, and then the kids, and then the ones suckling at their mother's breast. What are you talking about? Hope! How about some water? Screw the hope. How about some intense diplomatic action to save the lives of millions of people that are going to die because they can't feed themselves, they can't find drinking water, they're dying of worm diseases from waterborne illnesses and stuff. Hope? Come on, Mr. President. Hope is really cool when you're running that word, when you're running for president, when you're working a political campaign. That's a good one, especially when the United States has come out of 8 years of murderous, warmongering, crazy people running the country. But Jesus, God, that's when hope, the word hope really works. Hope. Change. Yes. But see, we are well fed to the point of half of us are obese. And even though we're losing houses one after another, we still have places to live for the most part. So when you talk about spreading the idea of hope, you'll pardon me if I turn away and look kind of shameful, okay?
Of survival. Your servant here, he has been told to say it clear, to say it cool. It's over, it ain't going any further. And now the wheels of heaven stop. You feel the devil's riding crop. Get ready. And do his job like a man. And
hey, truth seekers, it's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
It's 10 before the hour. So to sum up this Obama Nobel Prize thing, the bear puts it pretty succinctly in this email. This is what the bear writes. The Nobel Peace Prize, now available in select cereal and Cracker Jack boxes while supplies last. One in every 34,000 boxes. Hiya, hiya, hiya. Okay. I kind of feel sorry for Obama, though I really do, regarding this particular issue. You know, you enter a select group, or you're nominated to a very select group of people. The whole Nobel thing is a little bit freaky anyway when you think about who it's named after and who established the prize. Oh, God. Every time they talk about how much blast power a particular nuclear warhead gives off, they refer to tons of dynamite, right? Nobel, you know, Alfred. Oh, no. Oh, well. There were some things that he said that I thought, you know, once again, were very... Oh, never mind. Screw it. I've said that too many times. The Inuit... You know, what we uneducated white people in the lower 48, what we call Eskimos. The Inuit are worried about changing actions that they see in the sun. Ra sent this to me. It appears, they say, to be rising earlier and faster than usual. Scientists see this as an optical effect owing to rising temperatures in the north. This is at CBC website. It's interesting to see that so-called primitive people are aware that something is not right with the weather and the climate. Probably to a greater degree than so-called educated people. Come on, we know this. But anyway, some Inuit say they hope scientists coming to Nunavut for research as part of International Polar Year can help shed light on changes they're seeing in the sun, particularly how it's been showing up more often in the usually always dark winters. For the past several years, residents in the high Arctic have observed that the winter dark season is ending earlier than usual, with the sun coming up at a different place than what people are used to seeing. This has to do, I, you know, what have I been reading lately? Probably the same thing you have about you know, there is this periodic, and I don't know what the period is, thousands of years, hundreds of years, where the relationship vis-a-vis attitude toward between the Earth and the sun changes so that phenomena such as what are being reported by the Inuit are easily explainable with the celestial physics and so on and so forth. But anyway, an expert up there said, quote, the people are talking about, or no, this is one of the Inuit, I guess. The people are talking about earlier sunrise, more light in the dark season instead of being more total darkness than before. There are notices of more daylight earlier, and the dark season is not the real dark season that we used to know. A bit further south, the mayor of a town, Iglulik, said hunters have noticed the same phenomenon. The mayor said, quote, this year the sun started coming up so fast that it's almost like April when it's mid-February. He was referring back, of course, several months ago. Anyway, the scientists say they believe warming climate is responsible. They said they hope Inuit and scientists working during International Polar Year can work together on in-depth analysis of the observations. Yeah, write it down so that, you know, once whatever cataclysmic events occur, and I hope Inhofe is one of the first to go, I really do, when these cataclysmic events occur, there will be a recorded history of what we observed, what we knew, what the deniers insisted was nonsense, and so on and so forth. Right? Is that too cynical? when we come back, there's one more thing I want to add about the Obama administration. According to a report in Raw Story and vetvoice.com, the Obama administration is requesting a San Francisco court drop charges against John Yoo, the author of the torture memos. The U.S. Justice Department, run by Eric Holder, an employee of Barack Obama's, has filed a friend of the court brief that, quote, argues that because he was giving advice to the president on a national security matter, John Yoo should not be held accountable for his actions, as it would have a chilling effect on advice provided to future presidents. Now, that's the position of the Obama administration. Because John Yoo was giving advice to the president, he wasn't giving advice, he was making up lies and justifications for torture. He was destroying the Constitution of the United States. He was pissing all over the Geneva Conventions. He treated the verdicts and conclusions drawn from Nuremberg war trials over a two-year period of U.S. History post-war. He was concluding that nothing said at Nuremberg was valid, nothing, because you cannot have those decisions come down. And overall, they concluded one thing, that you cannot declare war and then absolve yourself from guilt because you were following orders or someone was giving you wrong advice. John Yoo did all that, and now the Obama administration is saying that you should not be held accountable for his actions. I'll tell you what, I just goddamn give up. Don't you? On Obama. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. So the Obama, this is Malloy program, the Obama administration has filed an amicus curiae, I've forgotten my Latin on that word, a friend of the court brief that argues that a San Francisco court should drop charges against John Yoo, former national security advisor or attorney or whatever the hell he was in the Bush crime family. Yoo should not be held accountable for his actions, as it would have a chilling effect on advice provided to future presidents. God, I hope that. I hate that. Andre writes, doesn't torture create a chilling effect on democracy? Doesn't obstruction of justice create a chilling effect? John Yoo is the one who said, as clearly as you want to interpret what he said, that crushing the testicles of the child of the detainee in order to make the detainee talk would be acceptable. Here's a transcript excerpt between international human rights expert Doug Castle and John Yoo. Castle, if the president deems that he's got to torture somebody, including by crushing the testicles of the person's child, there's no law that can stop him, the president? John Yoo, no treaty. Doug Castle, also no law by Congress? That is what you wrote in the August 2002 memo. John Yoo, I think it depends on why the president thinks he needs to do that. Some people at the debate compared Yoo's policies to Nazi Germany. He quickly denied that. Yet Yoo then immediately went on to argue that Bush can do anything he chooses to U.S. captives, even crush the testicles, not just of suspects, but their children. What more evidence is needed that Yoo and the policies he has helped write for the U.S. government are like the Nazis and Hitler? I was there. I heard the whole debate and recorded it all on tape. This is from Philip Watts. Sheila sent this to me. But this is the guy that the Obama administration now wants to protect and defend. To protect and defend. Is that not just beyond astonishing? As Matthew Alexander writes at vetvoice.com, the lack of accountability for the authors of the policy of torture and abuse during the previous administration has been disappointing, the lack of accountability. The fact that the current administration has not established an independent commission of inquiry, but is now also impeding prosecution of those involved, is alarming. This particular action is not evidence of a transparent government or a break with past policies. And Matthew Alexander writes, lawyers should be held to professional standards, and in every profession there are lines where the performance of one's duties, in this case advising the president, can cross over into criminal negligence. If a medical doctor provided such negligent advice that resulted in harm or death to a patient, certainly they could be held accountable in both civil and criminal proceedings. A lawyer working for the White House should not be afforded immunity. In fact, this lack of accountability opens a window for future indiscretion. As men and women in uniform, we too would be held responsible for our actions and the performance of our duties if we crossed into criminal conduct. And there is no special immunity granted to us because of our service to the Commander-in-Chief. That was decided at Nuremberg, wasn't it? Well, the bottom line, Obama is creating an immunity doctrine for torturers, according to Raw Story. And the ACLU said today that shielding the Bush administration from accountability for its dangerous torture policy severely threatens the future of constitutional liberty in the United States. Jamil Jaffer, director of director of the ACO's National Security Project, said in a conference call with reporters today, the Bush administration constructed a legal framework for torture. Now the Obama administration is constructing a legal framework for impunity. Jaffer said that while he credited Obama for having disavowed torture under his watch, he added that, quote, on every front, the administration is actively obstructing accountability by shielding Bush officials from civil liability, criminal investigation, and even public scrutiny for their role in authorizing torture. End quote. ACLU attorney Ben Wisner said, quote, it's the last month of 2009 and not a single torture victim has had his day in court. Not a single court in a torture case has ruled on the legality of the Bush administration's torture policies, end quote. Jaffer said that refusing to prosecute past acts of torture sets, quote, an extremely dangerous precedent, end quote, in the legal system. Torture victims, he said, can be denied their day in court solely based on assertions made by their torturers. That's scary beyond anything that Obama said at the Nobel Peace Prize award ceremony in Oslo about war is peace, and you know he has to order people in to be killed and to kill. But yeah, I'll take the peace prize. Sure, give me it. Man. Giving advice to the president on a national security matter. How is authorizing torture? What does that have to do with national security? This sounds like a page right out of Dick Cheney's playbook, doesn't it? Well, our national security is at stake here, so we have to torture people. How is our national security at stake? Well, it just is. How? In what manner? Some of these people that are being tortured are goat herders. They are cab drivers. They were 15 years old when they were snatched. What are you talking about? You wouldn't understand, Mr. Liberal radio talk show host. You should not be held accountable for his actions, Mr. You. John You should not be held accountable for his actions, as it would have a chilling effect on advice provided to future presidents. This is astonishing. This is the position of Eric Holder's Justice Department and Barack Obama's administration, that holding people accountable for crimes against humanity would have a chilling effect on actions, advice provided to future presidents by people who advocate torture. Oh, my goodness. I wonder if the Nobel Prize Committee was aware that this was a directive that had to come directly from the new Nobel Peace Prize recipient. You think? We'll come back after the break. We're going to open up some phone lines here and invite you to call in. All right. The number here is 877-996-2556.
Guaranteed to blow your head apart.
for a liberal helping of truth, it's More Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. Okay, very quickly, and then to your phone calls. Tom in Joshua Tree, California, writes regarding that statement about no peace in our lifetime that Obama made at his acceptance of the Nobel Peace Prize. Tom writes, Obama is not the leader of a nation. He's the leader of corporations that oppress the American people with a capitalist system that thrives on war. As Obama accepted the Nobel Prize, at the same moment, he's giving a complete pass to John Woo, or John Yoo, and any and all judicial officers who propose, endorse, and legalize torture. Yes, Obama the Christian, who finds hope and solution in illegal wars on innocent people. Who else but a religious man could ever conceive of such absurd atrocity? He says we will have war in order to ensure peace, the same way we had to burn villages to make them safe for democracy. The same realm of lies used by the same realm of mindless, heartless, egotistical fools who love power for the sake of power. Well-educated, ignorant fools who will contemplate even burning down the world to make it safe for Jesus or Allah or some other dumbass configuration of human hatred, ignorance, greed, and violence these creatures call their God. No peace in our lifetime, he says. Well, F you, chump. Get out of here. Go to your damn heaven and leave the rest of us alone. Tom. Ay, 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 ay. I don't know, man. I mean, I do know. I don't know. I do know. I don't know. Okay. Mark is in Los Angeles listening on KTLK. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Mike. I know you're running out of straws on Obama. There's one last thing, though. Dick Cheney doesn't come out of the woodwork for nothing. He's trying to cover up the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed case, because if that goes forward in New York publicly and the public sees that that man was tortured 183 times, waterboarded, stripped nude, had female interrogators, had his children, he was under the impression that his children were being starved in cells near him. Everything rides on this trial. I don't care if you're a Green Party supporter. In 2012, if we don't have enough evidence to show that we are a Green Party that can win, then we're just going to be another Ralph Nader in that equation. And the only way we can destroy, demolish, get rid of the Republican Party is to expose what they've done. This case is monumental. We have to keep our eye on the ball and focus on that if we want to win as a Green Party. And if Obama wants to win and regain some semblance of credibility in the world, he's got to keep pursuing this case. So I would just say, either side, if you want, whichever direction we choose, Green Party or backing or giving Obama another chance, whichever way we go, we have to get this trial in New York. We have to focus on the fact that the CIA uses torture to induce confessions. And this is case precedent. The 1999 Coretta Scott King case vindicated James Earl Ray. And if you go back to the evidence brought forth by the Citizens Commission of Inquiry, which proved that Phil Canal, the Attorney General, allowed the torture of James Earl Ray, then you will find that this is a long history of CIA modus operandi.
Well, I don't doubt for a moment what you're saying. I don't quite get the connection with the King case, although I know both Dexter King and Marty King, because we all lived in Atlanta for years and years and years and years and years and years and years. I'm not a real fan of the family because they are greed heads of the highest order, but that's not the point. The point is this. Both Dexter and Martin the Third, Marty, as he's called, have said, you know, in social settings, parties where I've been, that they do not believe that James Earl Ray acted alone in killing their father. In fact, they even, Dexter went so far as to say that he thought James Earl Ray was innocent. Not guilty, innocent. So, you know, like I said, I'm not a big fan of the family of Dr. King, the children, the three, what is there, four remaining children? I think three or four remaining children. But, you know, when you have a family who says that about the assassination of their father, as a matter of fact, Dexter spent time, I think, talking with James Earl Ray on a one-to-one basis and came away with that conclusion. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Thanks, Mark.
Learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird.
Oh, he just had another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
It's coming through a hole in the air. From those,
it's about 25 before the square hour. One more email here from Barry. Mike, there's a case to be made that you is subject to criminal liability, but this situation you're talking about is a tort case. They are seeking damages against you, not justice or judicial conclusions. There is a difference, and while I personally like nothing more than to see John Yoo clapped in irons and serving hard time, a decision in this, the Padilla tort case, is not going to be the best venue to make that happen. I'm not a lawyer, but having government officials subject to tort challenges in cases like this is not going to be productive. More importantly, it will not set precedent. I want to see you held criminally accountable and have his law license lifted. Barry. Okay. Fair enough. But I look at the response or the amicus brief filed by the Obama administration saying that this case should be dropped because someone should not be held liable for the advice they give to the president regarding matters of national security. I have to say I wasn't aware, because I didn't read far enough, I guess, that this was a civil case and not a criminal case. Now, with Barry's email, it's easy to understand that it is not a criminal case. Otherwise, there would be all sorts of actions going on around this case that are not occurring, is what I'm trying to say. And not saying it very well. So, okay, if Barry presents the idea that this is a civil case, which it is, and that's not the best place to bring John Yoo to any kind of justice, all right. That certainly does make sense to me. It's not very satisfying, you know, but it does make sense. But I wonder if it's not just this particular issue, though, is it, that the Obama administration is trying to stop, it has stopped, any attempt to investigate, hasn't it, the crimes committed by the Bush administration, actual provable crimes, including those committed by John Yoo, among scores of others. So I guess my overview is, even though Barry is right, this is a civil case, my overview is that any effort to stymie any action against any member, court action against any member of the Bush crime family, is an action that thwarts justice of some sort. But I I'll defer to Barry because obviously he knows more about this than I do. It just, it's difficult to accept that. You know what I'm saying? Ben is in Buena Park, California. Hey, Ben.
Buena Park. Thank you very much. You know, Mike, I sometimes I think maybe you're just being hard on Obama because it's the dramatic, you know, thing that makes things so interesting.
Really? You think that this program would involve itself in phony expressions in order to what? In order to what?
Not phony. You know, I hate
or dramatic or anything I say. I don't go after Obama for drama. I do it because he told me he was a Democrat. He told me that he was going to effect change. He told me to have hope. Now, I grant you, that's all he said. He didn't say he was going to end war, end poverty, solve the problems. But the implication was, at least to me, was that this was a man who was going to be different from George W. Bush. And except for around the edges in a few, to me, minor situations, he is following Bush policy.
Okay, now let me pose this question to you. Because you just said around the edges. Except for around the edges, it's all the same thing. Now, how many millions of years has it taken us to get here where we are today?
What do you mean? Get here in terms of what?
Our species, our evolution.
Oh, okay. A long time.
Yeah. And, you know, so you see that you are, at least you can see that you're the crust. I think our ancestors didn't even see that much.
The what?
Our ancestors. Are you know, the people that came before us that, like, are responsible for us, who, like, you know, we are their progeny?
Yeah, I didn't mean to define the term ancestor. I just meant, what are you talking about?
Mike, we are right here on the...
What?
We're right here where things are actually... We have right now as the chief of state... For, you know, the progeny of the slaves.
No, he wasn't. Barack Obama was never.
You're right.
He didn't come from.
You're right.
Ben,
you're right.
What?
Now wait, but the progeny. I mean, or his ancestors should have been slaves, just because they didn't get wrapped up in our American slave trade. It doesn't denigrate
okay,
where
Ben,
he's at right
Ben,
now.
Ben, wait a second. Your argument just went out the window. Hey, Ben, thanks for calling. No, Barack Obama's people were not slaves. Everybody who's dark-skinned or has ancestry in Africa, believe it or not, was not a slave was not involved as a victim in the slave trade. I know that's hard for a lot of white people to get their minds around, but trust me on this, it's true.
But what he was saying is, darn it, they should have been slaves.
Well, because they're, you know, like I said,
damn,
a lot of white people can't get past that thing that says, well, if you look like a African person or have a blend of African, you know, genetic whatever, because I, as a white person, that's the first thing I see, then you have to have been the, you know, the offspring of somewhere back in your heritage slaves. A lot of white people can't understand that, no, really, as bad as slavery was, as many millions who were sucked into that particular Holocaust, oh, well. Till is in Austin, Texas.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, Till.
Hi. Well, I'm a long-time, ever more reluctant Democrat.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about baseball, but I think I'm starting to feel like a Chicago Cubs fan. Associating with the Democrats has given me an inferiority complex.
Oh, big time, yeah.
And you know, why do we always have to be the lesser evil? And, you know, what fun is there in being a cop if we always have to play the good one?
Yeah, right.
I mean, I think it's time for us to show those bastards what Democrats really stand for. You know, no more junior partner.
Well, I feel that way. You feel that way. A lot of people feel that way. But the people who have the power, that's corporate America, they understand and know how to control people of any political party except anyone who's not a Democrat or Republican. When I say any political party, I mean, you know, the two majors. They know how to control. So, you know, you and I may feel that way, but we're not there. You know, we haven't been bought. We're not owned. You know.
Yeah, I know. Well, and I guess I'm getting off my original theme here, but you know, it always comes down to when the elections come around. You know, it's always a stand down. You know, for you know, Greens and alternate party people. You know. Do we want, you know, Sarah Palin to win? If we don't vote for Obama, Sarah Palin's going to win. Well, you know, I'm so sick of always having to take the lesser of evils. I mean, it's the difference of a slow death versus a fast death. And I think I'm to the point where I'm ready to say, screw it. Either you Democrat, you know, you Democrats don't want Sarah Palin, then you vote Green, because I'm not voting for, unless it's someone like Kucinich. If it's Obama or anybody but Kucinich or someone very much like him, screw it. I'm not voting for him. And either, you know, they can vote for the Green candidate.
Well, I hear you loud and clear, Till. You know, I've reached that frustration level too. I hate to opt out of a system that's based on my not opting out. At least in theory, it's based on anyone who has the legal right to vote one way or the other. And if people start opting out of that system, then, you know, politics like nature will not accept a vacuum. Something will rush in, and we all know what rushes in, neo-fascists. So, I'm not sure what to do. If the system, though, has abandoned me, and the system is producing nothing but this move toward fascist America, well then, you know, why should I be an instrument of my own hanging, you know?
Before he can see the sky, yes, and how many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows that too?
California lawyer writes in, Mike, the amicus brief filed by the Obama administration is about protecting executive privilege. What really needs to happen here is that Yu's law license should be yanked by the California State Bar. Let's see if they have the guts to do it. And Michael and Roswell suggests that, yeah, okay, it's a civil case, but maybe through discovery in a civil case, some of these crimes committed by Yu can be exposed. I don't know. I said before, when Nancy Pelosi declared that impeachment was off the table, that looked like the end of it, that probably the most criminal, you know, I don't know, maybe there were some worse ones back in the 19th century, but the most criminal administration in the history of U.S. presidency is going to get off scot-free. And I think that's precisely what's going to happen. any action taken by foreign courts that under the premise of universal jurisdiction, as was handled, handled by the Spanish court, where it concerned Augusto Pinochet, the Chilean dictator, any action against any American member of the Bush crime family under that doctrine should have happened by now. Is it going to happen at all? I realize there was one. There's one case, I think, that's still in the Spanish courts. But I do believe that these people are going to get off completely free. A, B, it will set precedent. Anyone who goes for the presidency of the United States, I think, Mr. Obama included, Al Gore included. I mean, you know, I don't know, Dennis Kucinich too. Who knows? Anyone who goes for the office understands what comes with it. The closest thing in this lifetime that they will ever experience in terms of absolute power. And we know what absolute power does. So, I don't know. My head hurts trying to figure it all out. Doesn't yours? Linda is in New York City. Hey, Linda.
Hello, Mike.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I listen to you all the time, and you are such a comfort because I am so disappointed in what's going on. But I'm still, you know, with Obama and him following the Bush protocol and my whole laundry list of things that of reservations that I had before I voted for him, okay, have all come back to haunt me. You know, we've been fooled again, it seems like. And it's just hard to hold on to your democratic, progressive principles with all the corruption in the Senate, you know. And
well, you know, I have a suggestion, Linda, and this is a suggestion to myself and maybe to you. It's not hard to hold on to your principles if you realize, like I have finally, that the Democratic Party doesn't represent those principles. I still consider myself to be a capital D Democrat, a capital P progressive, and a capital L liberal. And my refuge all my life, I thought, was the Democratic Party. Big mistake on my part over the last, 25 or 30 years. So, and I think Bill Clinton, to me, and Jimmy Carter were the two prime examples that woke me up a little bit, like, hey, yo, both parties are corrupt. You're going to get the same thing from each one, except around the edges. So wake up, smell the coffee. And I think that's where people like you and me are at. We're still Democrats, but, not with this party. Can't do it.
No, can't do it.
So.
Can't do it. And you're so comforting, and I love listening to your show. And
well, that's
it's
kind.
Great to speak to you, Mike.
Well, that's kind of you to say. Thanks, Linda.
Okay, good night.
All right, good night. Take care. Lord, have we got time for one more? I think so. Stephen is in Burbank, California. Hey, Stephen.
Hi, you, Mike.
I'm all right.
That letter from the lawyer kind of set off my little thing a little bit. I was going to say that if any of these criminals are picked up, taken someplace for trial, that Obama would send in the A-team. He would send in call an airstrike or threaten or do something to get them free and, you know, just let them walk around, freeze the bird.
I don't think it would go that far, but...
Yeah, I know.
But, go ahead.
Yeah, well, you know, he would, if it did happen, he would have to do it because of... this public sentiment, the right wing, forcing us to dance to their tune, you know? And a scatterbrained idea would be, let's get the government to take over half the media, you know? Let's give them pennies on the dollar and call it eminent domain. I mean, it is for the public good. It's kind of scatterbrained.
All right. Well, you know what? You are, Stephen. You are more cynical than me. I got to go. Thanks, pal. I appreciate you checking in. James is in East Bay listening on Green 960. Hey, James.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, I got about a minute.
Yeah, I just think you're being a little bit too hard on Obama. And let me explain real quick.
Okay.
First of all, he's only been in office for several months now, and you can't expect him to reverse, you know, what, four centuries of this stuff overnight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it seems that the American people just suddenly and recently woke up and had a realization of the Southern strategy.
But can I expect him, you're right, but can't I expect him not to file a brief in this case against John Yoo, where I say, you know, on the Obama administration, don't prosecute him. Huh?
We need to be real careful at this critical time. And let me refer you to the New York Times last Wednesday had an article about the Comcast-GE merger and the party crashing on the same page. And if any critical reader could relate all of that information on that one page, if you read between the lines, and also a Rolling Stone article maybe a few issues back about infighting, if you can just look on the cover, there's a little small thing on one of the covers of the Rolling Stone. Mm-hmm. And it'll explain a lot if we can do some, you know, critical reading and thinking.
All right, well, I hear you, James. And listen, I'm out of time, man. Let's talk again when the show is a little bit, you got a little bit more time to go. Thanks, James. I hear what you're saying, but on the other hand, you know, I'm not expecting Obama to turn things around. I'm just expecting him to follow the law, I guess. I don't know what I expect. See you tomorrow night, y'all. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.